I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in downtown Baltimore. Yes, I'm back. I had a lovely trip to South Carolina, enjoyed. Now I'm back home, and yeah, I'm going to follow up on what I said. I'm going to do what I said I was going to do last week, which was talk about the documentaries. Well, the first one, Vanessa Guillen, that was released on Netflix, and Master of Light. Master of Light was released on HBO. Both of those docs touched my heart in a very specific way, and I want to talk about them because they both, believe it or not, they both have very common themes. Trauma and family are the two themes that stick out to me. Also, broken systems stick out to me. So more on that a little bit later. But first, a couple of things. Number one, Fantasia is my Sarah. Oh my goodness. You know, give me a second. If you're not Greek, if you're not a member of a Black Greek Divine Nine, how about that? If you're not a member of the Divine Nine organization, you can, you know, just hold on for a second. So, y'all know, if you're familiar with Historically Black or the D9 orgs, you know that honorary membership, actually, this is not even a D9 thing. Honorary membership is a tool that the body, the grand body, or at least the leadership uses for each organization. And it's not just NPHC. It's literally all fraternal organizations or fraternities and sororities that are social and service-based. They use the honorary membership piece as a recruitment tool. And the idea is you get the most high-profile folks that you can that will represent your organization pretty well. Everyone does it. I know that in Greek culture, and I saw the wildest video the other day. People like to justify and gatekeep in ways that are not healthy. Justify bad behavior and gatekeep in ways that are not healthy. I watched a video the other day of someone who was clearly a member of, I guess it doesn't matter what org they were a part of, but they were a D9 member, D9 Divine Nine, which is moniker that is used to talk about NPHC organizations, the nine historically Black fraternities and sororities. Anyhow, she was clearly in one of them. And anyway, she said that she was a member for 30 years, but that her definition of financial, that is to say, a dues-paying member of these orgs, was the service that she put in. Not necessarily the money that she paid to the organization, but the in-kind time and energy that she put into the organization throughout her 30 years. And that was the most confusing. That was one of the most confusing videos I've ever seen in my life. I won't live on this forever, but I just think these are social service organizations. That's what they are. We aren't the talented 10th. We are varied. We're complex. We have folks like any other organization who pay their money to say they're a part of this thing and then never do anything. Every organization, every group that you're in, if you have 100 members, If you have 10 members, you know two of them are absolutely not going to do junk. Actually, and if you think about it, if you really want to make it real life, if you've got 10 members, the likelihood of five of them or four of them not contributing to the work of your group is pretty high. Everybody has worked in a group before, completed group assignments. You know that not everybody, it's rare for everyone to give the same amount of energy every time. At the same time. So anyway, at the end of the video, I wasn't even sure if she was financial in the first place, because again, she spent so much time saying that the work that she did paid her dues, which is an oxymoron. Whatever group you're a part of, whether it be a religious organization, which I think sometimes people forget, or a service organization, you need money to operate. And fraternities and sororities are no different. And one of the ways that these organizations maintain their buildings, the buildings where the headquarters of their organizations, pay the staff at the headquarters, and then continue to do the work in the community, provide member items, and have operating budgets, is that membership pays money annually. This is literally why Giving Tuesday, you can look back on it and you can determine whether or not it actually yields you a lot of fruit, the fact remains, Giving Tuesday is a thing because all organizations need members to contribute to their operating dollars. And how you do that is by saying that each year, either each year or each month, or it's like you pay your membership in ideally organizations, regardless of whether or not they're Greek or not, Greek letter organizations, ask you to be a member and pay annual dues. And then they also invite you to participate in the annual fundraising campaign or to contribute a certain amount of money per month, pledge to contribute a certain amount of money per month to the operating costs. Weirdo, like the mental gymnastics that people be going through. Like there's a whole debate about, the fact remains, you have people who pay their money and then wear the letters and don't do anything. And then there are people who pay their money and do a bunch of the work. And then there are people who fiscally can't keep up with the annual dues, but they want to be around the organization. The problem is that's where we kind of get into murky territory and into trouble. And a lot of folks think that they themselves are the gatekeepers of who should be members of their organization and how true members of their organization should act and what they should do, how they should perform. And that is, you've lost the plot. Because was in the 90s. And in the 90s, all of the Divine Nine organizations decided that they were going to turn away from the activities that were putting their organizations and, more importantly, individuals who were interested in becoming members of them organizations, put those activities aside. Everybody signed national pledges or a pledge. Every organization signed a pledge to not engage in those activities. And it reminds me, every day somebody gets on social media, and first off, social media is a wild place, but every day somebody gets on there and reminds me that you really out here doing your own thing, making up your own rules, because no organization defines membership based on what you did 30 years ago. You know what they do? They define it about what you're doing right now, weirdo. How you're contributing. And again, the person that pays their money to the organization is almost as valuable as the person in a way, you're as valuable as the person who's physically doing the work at the local level, local, regional, and international level. Because we need operating dollars, weirdo. Like, who are these people? Just sad. And they're part of the reason. They're part of their gatekeeping and their weird... That mentality is part of the reason why we still have in court cases, we still have people who are engaging in risky behavior behind because they think they are the keepers of the organization and maintaining the integrity of the organization. And last time I checked, unless you were a national or international officer, or I dare say your international president, we can be selective. We don't have to take everybody. But dag, that's weird. Anyway, but the reason why I'm even talking about this is because back to the honorary membership piece. So honorary members, again, it goes back to raising the level of, just attracting people to the organization. Again, organizations, this is not secret information. All organizations thrive. Their operating budgets, at least the baseline, is membership, is members paying dues and new members paying dues is built into everyone's budget. That nonprofit, that's what it is. That's what it is. You build that into your budget. And anyway, so honorary members are a way to help you.
I keep yawning.
I'm sorry, but honorary members are a way to help you keep in the Greek letter organization sphere. But not just Black. It's Greek letter organizations. Period. All of them, but it helps to attract new members. Now, I will say this, Black Greek letter organizations seem to me, and that's my experience because I'm an actual leader on the local level and do work on the regional and international level. I don't know what the numbers are. How undergrad versus alumni, I would dare say that you will always have more alumni members than you will have undergrad members. But in the Black Greek letter world, there's incentive for you to continue to stay around. And so more people do that because there's it's like a whole thing. I don't know with non-Greek letter, NPHC orgs do, but I don't know if we're the only ones that do this, but NPHC member organizations induct new members in the alumni level, whereas I think some other Greek letter organizations only, you can't become members of them as an alumni after you've graduated. It's only for graduation purposes. And again, the rationale is pretty simple. These Black Greek letter organizations, and you can argue because six of the nine were established on the same campus, Howard University, right? So you can make an argument as to, what the heck is the purpose of you all being, all of us being here? And the reality of it is we have different answers for all of them, but that doesn't matter. The point, the main through line, though, is that all of these organizations were established not only to be support systems at the time on campus for these Black students. Again, three of the nine were not founded on an HBCU, which means that they were founded. They truly needed to be supports for each other, both on campus and then post school. Post-graduation, especially Sigma Gamma Rho, that they were created as established as a safety net for those students, but then also a way to pour back into the community. And indeed, all of them at their core were meant to pour back into the community. specifically the Black community. And so the ways in which that these organizations not only did it as an undergrad, but continued through adulthood was to establish alumni chapters. Now, every organization, every NPHC organization came to how they did that differently. But nevertheless, the reason why alumni membership is a thing, or at the very least becoming a member of an NPHC organization is a thing, is because these were not just meant to be collegiate groups. These were meant to be social organizations that would support a member throughout the different stages in their life. So again, undergrad, postgrad, and as all of our organizations have evolved, there are different ways that members are asked to contribute. And so honorary members, again, high profile individuals that are designed to help recruit more folks to help do a number of different things. But one of the main things is to help support the operating budget so that they can support the work that they do in the community and in the international, on the global stage. But then also, honorary membership has its place too. So it's an opportunity for these high profile individuals not only to get more energy behind the work that they're doing. It's beneficial to them too, because now the minute that you become a member, so like Fantasia, so she's a member of the organization, Fantasia and a number of Barbara Lee, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who is just a super impressive woman to me. But anyway, now you have at your disposal a group of people who, if it makes sense, can support a nonpartisan cause that is going towards the mission that can ultimately help the organization meet its mission even better. So it's mutually beneficial, right? Honorary membership has its place, and there are certain asks that these orgs have to, that these honorary members have to live up to. There's also, as you stay in the organization, there's different levels that you can attain throughout the years of being financial, which again is, that's why it puzzles me. Like, I have been in my sorority for over 13 years. It'll be 14 next November. Wait, it is. I'm working on 14 years, right? Anyway, right? Yes, because 2008, I was 10 years old in the organization. 2028, I will be 20 years old in the organization. And so I have surpassed a level which of continuous financial membership, which grants me to go to the next phase in the organization. I don't have to, but I obviously want to, and that's to become a life member, and life membership has its perks. And there are other member levels of my organization that are, it's public. That's not proprietary information that I'm sharing. But I guess all of that goes back to, I just don't know why people be saying what they be saying. Like, you just be making stuff up and it is not in line with what your organization is saying. Also, I'm also bringing up Fantasia because I'm hearing, based on her videos are viral. Everybody has seen, essentially, she's in a hotel room. It looks like a hotel, like a suite. And she's looking at all of her gifts that she was given, and she's got her sorority blazer on. And she is extremely excited, and she's doing what essentially comes down to like a new member show, like a showcase, but like she's singing, she's dancing, she's doing the STM Shake the Monkey. She's excited, and you can tell, and she's having a good time. And apparently, so while Sigma Gamma Rho members were like, who are on social media, were eating it up. And it would be announced right before the end of November, which I think is just stunning. Because what a way to end the Founders Month. And we still own 100. We celebrating 100 years right up until 101. So cut it out. So you'll live. But anyway, but there are people that are hating on the choice of adding Fantasia. And I just don't know. And by people, I mean other Greek organ, other Divine Nine org members. And I'm just confused as to why that would be. None of that makes sense to me. Other than just being hate. So again, it's you gatekeeping one way or the next, like, oh, she should have, literally people are saying she should have been an XYZ. And I'm like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? At the end of the day, your organization is not your personality trait. Do you get that? For you, and also for folks, let me finish this thought. Being a Greek member, a black Greek letter organization member is not a personality trait. And for those who, if you are a GDI, and if you are a GDI and you see someone who is clearly acting like being Greek, black Greek letter organization member is their personality trait, pray for them and keep them moving, because they got some other things that need attention. They've got other things that need attention. Like they just need to work on themselves. On the other end, so it's not a personality trait. And then also, oh shucks, I was about to say something. Shoot, it was gonna be good too. Oh, that's what it was. So yeah, being a black Greek letter organization member is not a personality trait. And so whoever, like there are some dynamic members, some high profile dynamic members in the fields of education, entertainment, politics, activism in all of the organizations, past and present. Give it a rest. Give it a rest. Just be cool. Be excited for other folks. Like, do you think I ate my heart out, and I'm gonna be transparent in this moment. I ate my heart out when Tika Sumter became a member of another organization because I love her. But at the end of the day, she was super excited to do it. Ledisi ate my heart out because she became another member of an organization, NPHC organization. But her mama was a member of the organization that she became a part of. Duh, I love legacies. Some of y'all don't, and some of y'all need to sit and reflect, because anyway, that's a whole nother conversation. But I'm confusion on y'all just be making up any old little thing, and ain't none of it got to do with the health and with a healthy organization or the sustainability of your organization. You just be making stuff up. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, you're not contributing fiscally to your organization at all. So yes, it's a both and scenario. You need to be paying your money to the organizations. You also need to be paying in your time and energy to these organizations too. They're not just for you to sit back in judgment of other people. And again, being a member of these organizations is not a personality trait. You need to have been a fully fledged, formed, whole individual outside of these organizations with a personality of your own. And then these organizations just are great ways for you to do the service in the community and the work globally that perhaps you would not have the advantage to do or the ability to do, but for the resources that the financial and people resources that the organizations provide you. Like, give it a rest. The other thing that I want to say, y'all make me sick with assigning, and there's a certain person or a certain type of person that does this, but if I see one more video, and I know I am, but if I see one more video of someone who says that Black Greek letter organizations are demonic or some way, or are just not good for someone's spiritual growth. I'm gonna check out of social media for a minute. I saw a video of someone who was clearly grabbing at straws, but this is not the first time that I've heard this argument. Literally, people who are ex-members who've denounced their letters, because that's a thing, denounce their organizations, will turn around and say the reason why that they renounced their membership, gave up their membership in these organizations, will attach a spiritual reason as to why they did it. And I just don't, again, if being a member of that organization is not a personality trait and you recognize that, why in the world would you say, I'm at a loss. I'm at a complete loss for words. Because here's the deal. The people who are renouncing their letters and then going on social media and making videos about it usually are the people who were in a lot of dirt, doing a lot of dirt, and thought better of it, was ashamed of the dirt that they did, and want redemption. And then, but instead of removing themselves from the people who might have helped lead them off the path of whatever path that they wanted to be, again, anything that is not service oriented and about building character and supporting the community is not of that organization. It's not what the organizations are about. But all of these ex members of these orgs coming out and saying it's demonic. And usually, as a Christian woman, I'm gonna go ahead and say it's usually people who are evangelical Christians who are like, oh my goodness, it's demonic. And let me tell you why. Cut it out. Y'all were the same ones that were engaging in that foolishness. Y'all were the ones that if I had my druthers on you, I would have snatched your letters, because you are engaged in the foolishness that is taking us to court and getting. But before that, what's more important than us going to court and members going to court and potentially serving jail time is literally the people getting hurt. Y'all have seen the stories in news. You have. Y'all need Google is free. Y'all don't need me to tell you all the horror stories that have been in that are connected to undergraduate and alumni chapters of not just Black Greek letter organizations, but all of them. These are social service organizations. Social service organizations. So you have fun and you do work. But the real reason why, the real reason why you're there is because you're doing work, weirdo. Like, again, the next time you see one of those videos, not that they're ever going to give you a straight answer, but I want to talk to someone who is, no, do I? Yeah, I do. One time I want to talk to someone who's an ex-member who genuinely thinks the organization itself is demonic. Because I challenge them to tell me what they did when they were in undergrad, what they were engaged in, and who they were engaged in. Because it definitely wasn't sanctioned. It definitely was not something that they could report out to their international leadership and still and not get any sanctions for. They were the ones doing dirt, and they turned around and realized that they should never have been doing it in the first place, and they were surrounding themselves with people who were doing dirt. And I'm not saying that individual chapters could not be engaged in foolishness, because every organization, regardless of whether or not they're Greek letter or Black Greek letter, have people who just want to do their own thing. But a lot of times it's also people who are just like that lady who was like, I've been a member for 30 years, but I paid my dues in the work that I was doing. Making up stuff as they go along, who are rogue members, or maybe she's not even a rogue member. It's just that mentality is weird if she's a dues paying like financial member. But like it's those underground members. It's those people who got it 30 years ago or got it 20 years ago. And this is no shade to shoot, got it 2 years ago. And now all of a sudden they want to turn around and stunt and start making up what they think is the appropriate way to engage with the organization. Put the energy in its place. You're denouncing the entire organization based on some foolishness that you got into at the local level. And again, I'm not absolving the local level leaders, because if they were into it, they need to be punished. Everybody needs to be punished, because that's not what these organizations stand for. But like, stop with these entire organizations are demonic. Cut it out. If you want to keep it 100% funky, what little I know about all the other organizations, and let's keep it a buck. My organization, they're Christian based. These people who established these organizations, their faith was Christianity. Now, do we have members, a large growing population of members that are practitioners of different faiths, or for the sake of this argument, are of different faiths? Absolutely. All of us have huge numbers of Muslim faith members, as well as a growing population of Jewish faith. But definitely, they're nonprofit organizations that are not religious organizations, but they have principles that are religious. So y'all are weird, and you probably weren't even brought into the organization right to begin with. Like, and by right, I mean you were probably hazed out of your mind, and you were learning from someone who was making up their own rules as they went along. And that has nothing to do with the organization. And that's the last thing I want to say on that. That was just on my spirit, because being Greek is not a personality trait. Oh my goodness. Nor is it so powerful that it could literally lead to the spiritual, shake your spiritual foundation. In negative interactions in anywhere. It doesn't have to be in Greek life, Black Greek life, but anywhere can shake your religious faith or your resolve and what you thought you knew or how you saw the world. Like any organization, any circumstance can do that for you. It's called renewal. And again, sometimes unfortunately the trauma that's attached to it can help give you a good or a bad view. Or anyway, I'm going way too deep. But and again, I'm not sharing any proprietary information. But it's important to talk about. Like, if you're a GDI and you have no interest in becoming a member of a Black Greek letter organization, okay. Being a GDI is not a personality trait either. That's another piece of that. Anyway, I just had to get that off my chest. But let me switch gears really quickly. So, yeah. And I will bring that up again. I had a whole episode a couple of years ago. It must have been, was it 2016? Was it 2018? Yeah, it was 2018. I think I had an episode. No, it wasn't colorism in the Greek, Black Greek letter community. But one of these days I'm going to talk about that. Because I'm hopeful. I'm seeing some good things, but I'm still seeing some wild things as well. So I'll talk about that. Maybe not just colorism, but featureism. I don't know. I think it's time to talk about how people present and the ways the organization responds to that. I might bring in somebody to have that conversation too, but anyway, it's important to me, because I'm also seeing a lot of hate against people who are specifically in the sorority and the sororities, not just mine, but in the sororities. I'm seeing hate against people who are mask presenting, women who are mask presenting. And I just want to talk it through because it's weird. Because while they might be mask presenting, they certainly still identify very much. And I'm specifically talking about in the sororities. They still identify very much as being a member of those sororities. And I think there's just some foolishness. And again, I think some of this feedback is not coming from the members themselves, but they're coming from people who want to be members, who are GDI. I don't know. Anyway, I'll talk about that at another date, at a later date. But yeah, anyway, so let me switch gears. There's really no good way to pivot to this. So I'll just share that I'm going to talk about Master of Light, and I am Vanessa Guillen in a second. And I do want to do a little trigger warning. I'm not going to be graphic about what happened to Vanessa Guillen. But I am going to, I'm not going to be graphic about that, but I am going to be talking about violence against women, drug use. That's not specific to her story. That's more specific to the Master of Light story. Childhood trauma, which is more specific to the Master of Light story. I'm going to talk about those things. So I'm going to put it in the show notes as well, but I just wanted to give that heads up. So yeah, stay tuned. In the next segment is all about I Am Vanessa Guillen and Master of Light. Okay, so let me start with talking about the doc, I Am Vanessa Guillen. So, a couple of weeks ago, right before Thanksgiving, the Friday before Thanksgiving, I believe, was, what was that emphasis day? It was Veteran Woman's Mental Health Awareness Day, and I apologize, but I apologize for not getting the day correct. Hold on, let me Google it, girl, so I can stop being weird. Veteran Woman's Mental Health Day. November 16th, right. So, it was the Friday. It was the Friday before Thanksgiving. And so I remember, I know the organization that I work for did a few things. I know my sorority did a few things. There were local chapters that did something to commemorate the day. It's gaining traction. I do expect that as, you know, next year, certainly my chapter and many more chapters will do bigger events. Or even collaborate, and just organizations as a whole will collaborate to bring more attention and awareness to military women's mental health, because we know that women can do everything and more than a man can, give birth to a whole human being and sometimes multiple, and then pop right back to work like ain't nothing happened. Or just hold down whole groups of connected people, family or otherwise, and still be expected to do, literally, I'll go you one better. Those who have menstrual cycles are expected to just go to work and deal with massive cramping every 30 days for like a week. Just supposed to just be. That was the wildest thing that I first, the first thing that I ever learned. And I thought that's when I truly understood, not truly understood, but I learned another side of injustice. I'm a black person. So being a black child, you're not exempt from having that conversation unless one of your parents is not Black and they don't see the, none of your parents see the need, or if they are both Black and either way, in either scenario, your parents don't see the need to talk about some of the particular things that you'll come up against in society. But nevertheless, so I understood, but my parents knew better. And so I understood oppression as a child understands it, right? And discrimination and racism as a child would understand it. But when I became a teenager, well, actually, I wasn't even a teen. I was 12. So I was a preteen. And I had my cycle. And my, this was probably indicative of just my body, because my body's reaction was pretty terrible. I was in a lot of pain. A lot of pain that made me nauseous for a while there, and it, every cycle, but then it kind of mellowed out. And then in high school, it kind of became less and less. And then in college, I guess that's when my PCOS really began to kick off. But I've shared before that when I got my, when I went to my doctor and I got an exam from my doctor was like, oh, it's cool. You just going through puberty. It's just your hormones, girl. You be all right. A simple examination would have told him that I was living with PCOS, but whatever. It's part of the reason why I don't have male doctors now, if I can help it. I don't know. It just makes me feel better. And if I can really help it, I have Black woman doctors, if I can really help it, or at least a woman of color doctor, if I can help it. anyway, but like I remember thinking, so I'm just supposed to go to school when I feel like garbage. I'm still supposed to go to school when I'm hurting on my lower half. I'm still supposed to go to school. I'm supposed to do PE. I'm supposed to just be around y'all, and I can't go lay down. Like, I guess I could, you know, you could always go to the nurse's office, but like every month. And so that was, how a Black child is told, or at least I was, as a Black child was told, you know, you might go in the store, this little country old store, you might touch something, or you might be in there and people who don't like you because you are Black will look at you crazy, will look at you funny, will treat you differently because they don't like you. And I remember the first time I connected what my parents were saying to an actual experience was, I was in the gas station in some country old town, in Missouri. And, but it wasn't near where, Kansas City or anything like that. I don't, maybe it was Ozarks, can't call it. Anyway, but I was in there with my dad, and he was buying gas or something. I don't remember. But I touched a piece of candy because I thought I wanted some. And then I knew my daddy was not going to buy it for me, and that I needed to use my little old allowance money to buy it. And I decided that I did not want to spend my money on this piece of candy because it was not like a name brand. You know, I was being fiscally responsible. But anyhow, I don't even know how... What I heard must have been loud, but my daddy didn't act like he heard it. And I think I was too stunned to ask my daddy later once we left the gas station if he heard it. But I definitely remember there was a white mama, and maybe a teenager behind us. I don't even know. I just knew that they were white behind us. And I remember one of them, and I'm assuming it was the apparent, I don't know, one said, it was white people behind us, two white people behind us, whatever their ages, two white people behind us, the person that I guess I identified as the adult said, don't touch where she just touched. And I remember thinking, that's odd. But at the same time, I also remember what my mama and my daddy told me, that people are going to be wild to you just because you're Black, like no other reason. They don't know you. You ain't spat in their mama face. you ain't did nothing. You ain't overseasoned they food. You didn't do nothing. You certainly don't have cooties. It's not like I coughed and licked my hand and then touched the packaging of the item. It's just, I touched it. I picked it up, put it back. And they said what they said. And again, I think I was so stunned and processing. And in that moment, I connected what my parents had been saying to that situation. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is not TV. This is for real. This do happen. I think I was so stunned that I didn't even bother bringing it up to my dad to see if he saw the same, if he heard the same thing that I heard. And so I just left it alone. But that was my first remembrance of, or that was the first time that I made the connection between what they were telling me and categorizing what I experienced to be what they were telling me. Like something that I would experience because they've already told me that. And so from there, I experienced way more than that, or many more situations as a child. I couldn't have been. I definitely remember being the height of the like a little bit taller than the counter, but not by much. So like my eyes, I remember my eyes being maybe a half a foot. Like I remember looking down on the candy, but not like by that far. I wasn't that much taller than where the candy was. And you know how the racks go in front of the gas station counters. They're like at an angle. And so I remember being taller than the rack, but I don't remember being that much taller than it. So I had to have been, I didn't hit my growth spurts. I didn't start getting tall for real until I was like 12 or 13. So I was definitely not more than 11 or 10 years old when this incident happened. I definitely remember being at my daddy's hip height. So, and cause I, again, my dad's 6'6", but I swore he was like 8 foot tall compared to me. I just knew he was 8 foot tall. So anyway, I remember I was a little person when this happened. And so flash forward to me getting my menstrual cycle. And I remember being, I got my menstrual cycle at camp. And I remember being embarrassed. It was like the last day at camp. And then I went home and then dad was like, oh, you got your decimal point. You got your dad. My dad is a jokester and trying to make light of the situation. I was embarrassed, but he was trying to make me feel better and make light of the situation because there was nothing I could do about it. It was. I just had to deal with it. And then because he's dad, he did not leave it up to my mama to go get me all the supplies that I needed. He brought it upon himself to go into the store and to get me variety, which to a 12 or 13 year old, like, I'm gonna just stop and say, y'all mean well, I know you do. But that was mortifying to me. I loved my daddy. I'm a daddy's girl. But that was mortifying. I wanted my mama to do that. So, you know, pick and choose. You know, find the boundaries. Because he was like, well, I don't know why I can't go. And then proceeded to just get, like, it felt like, at the time it probably wasn't this, but it felt like every brand of Kotex and all of them different ones just to try it out. Now, the pads, I was already mortified at the fact that now I had to wear what was the equivalent of a big old wad, like a whole bunch of gauze and toilet paper. I had to wear that now once a month, or a couple of days out of the month. And then feeling gross all the time. And then... trying to navigate my life, and then here come my dad trying to be supportive. Like, I did not appreciate it as much as I appreciate that now. But anyway, again, one of the most ghetto things that I thought of was, oh, I still got to go to school. You still want me to, you expect me to learn when I'm dealing with this pain, which if I think about it now, and not ghetto, because I don't want to, not ghetto, trifling. That was trifling. Hood rich is hood rich. You know, you do things that bring you joy, and it is what it is, and people might think it's unrefined, but if it brings you joy, who gives a crap? But trifling is literally You don't care who you hurt. You don't care how another person feels, how it impacts anyone else. This is what it is. And I don't care how you feel about it. So I thought it was trifling that I still had to go to school dealing with a level of pain I've never felt before, and feeling not clean, gross, and feeling like, and my dealing with my body aching in weird ways. Like, if you understand a person who's dealing with a menstrual cycle, you know your hormones, everything either hurts or is sensitive. And when I first began my cycle, everything hurt. I'm talking of everything hurt, because that's just how my body responded. And again, I shared before that I would get sick. In the early days, just nauseous because of it was directly related to the pain. And that's only happened to me a couple of times recently. And again, when the pain was too much, that's where the nausea reaction came in. I think it's a pretty typical reaction, but that's definitely how my body responds to extreme pain, or what I consider to be extreme pain at the time. And so I don't know if I could tolerate the level of pain, like what I would describe the level of pain now if I felt what I felt back when I was like 12. I don't know if I would consider that to be excruciating now, but it was excruciating back then because this is a person who never broke a bone in her body, ever. Never sprained anything, for real, never sprained. And I had, up until that point, I'd never sprained anything. And still to this day, knock on wood, I've never broken a bone. So I don't know excruciating pain except for what I experienced through the, initially through when, menstrual cycle. And then, recently, within the last year for, the fertility process, because there's just certain things and certain instruments that they have to use that are cause a lot of pain. And so anyway, so when I was a child, I just remember thinking, this is trifling. I don't want to do this. But then recognizing that, you know, I think everybody had the health class, or all the girls were brought into, you know how in, or at least in the American school system, how when you, like, maybe around sixth or seventh grade, the health teachers bring in, have an assembly for all of the people who identify as straight binary girls, or what is it? I'm trying to pick up on the lingo. Cis girls and cis boys. Well, that's not even perceived to be cis girls and cis boys. How about that? Anyway, and in that assembly, you talk about hygiene and you talk about the things that you need to do to, like, the things you go through. And so in the perceived cis girl one, they were talking about, you know, this is how you use a tampon, and this is what you do for a maxi pad, and this is how long you keep it in, and all of that stuff, like you wear it and all of that stuff. And this is what you do for pain. But nobody ever talked about, like, it felt very much, oh, these are the things you do to cope, keep it moving. And looking back on it, I'm just like, that's messed up, because you just take it for granted that we, from a child, are taught to just grin and bear it with our pain, with everything that we're going through. We're perceived to be super delicate, or at least that's the stereotype, that women are delicate and they can't handle things. But at the same time, they're meant to be, that they're pilloried for not being strong and not being able to handle things. And if you really want to split it in there, there are certain, like, women of color, specifically in Mike's instance, I'm just focusing on Black women. Black women are perceived to get it done, be strong and get it done. And their vulnerability is not addressed in any meaningful way as a group. We're just pilloried for being too strong. But at the same time, if we're weak, we're also you know, you lamb, you, we get it coming and going. Anyhow, so I remember thinking that in the very beginning, like, oh, this is kind of trifling. And so I always, I've shared this before, that I got a lot of military service connected people in my family, either active duty or retired. I got a lot of them on my mama's side for sure. And I also got a few of them on my daddy's side. I can't living in Maryland, specifically Baltimore, but in Maryland overall, I can't throw a rock and not hit somebody who's either done time in the ROTC or enlisted or who's active duty or who's recently retired. Or, I can't throw a rock or, who are military service connected. And that could mean also the guard people, too. So, and to be honest with you, the people, I mostly know women who are military service connected. Like, even on my mama's side of the family, like, yeah, my uncle and his son, one of his sons is military service connected, but like overall across, and my one of my brothers is military service connected, and one of my cousins on my daddy's side, but like by and large, I can name on one hand right now, 5 men who are military service connected, but I've got 20 plus people in my family who are connected to the military, which means that the rest of them identify as women. And so I know a bunch of women who serve in the military. And so even when I moved here, the majority of the people that I know that serve or have served are still women, even in my sorority. And so, you know, I've always known women to have served, and I've always known them to be that deal and not always super organized. But definitely go-getters. If I ever wanted to get something done, I know I need to attach myself to someone who's to one of them women, because not that just because you were in the military means that you're going to get things done, but like the likelihood of you complaining about getting a lot of work done in a short amount of time is lower. If, in my experience, if I've partnered with a woman who is military service connected, because at the end of the day, that's their motto, right? Like, I don't care how you feel, let's just get this job done so we can go on to the next thing. And so that's my philosophy. I think I'd have been disciplined so many times if I was in the military, because I got a smart mouth. But anyway, at the end of the day, I like to get stuff done. And so I tend to turn to my military service connected women because they get it done. Anyway, and with little complaint too, you gotta love it. But I think in all the times that I've known, for as long as I've known military women, I think it's only been in the last, if I'm honest, it's only been in the last 3-4 years where I've seriously asked them questions about what it was like to serve, and especially for my active duty women, engaging in, you know, some of the trauma that they experience, even outside of service, like at the hands of other members. And earlier this year, my chapter was a part of Sigmund Amoreau's national conversation about our international conversation about women in the military, and especially women who might have been assaulted at the hands of another officer or another member of their unit. Or I apologize, I don't have the right language, but someone that served alongside them either was in charge. In the conversation that came up, it was usually, unfortunately, someone who was in leadership. Maybe not high leadership, but like the person that told their particular group of people what to do, like their squad, their group, their particular group of people what to do, like a smaller. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. You get it. Anyway, and so I'm just sitting there listening, and I'm just like, I've heard the stories before. I've heard about
I watched a whole documentary 4 years ago. This was what opened my eyes. 4 years ago, I watched a whole documentary of women who were survivors of sexual assault in the while on active duty. Some of them were assaulted while they were in the field. Others were assaulted while they were home training, like on the stateside training. And I remember that this one woman, she was assaulted by, what is the academy? What's the academy that is in Anacostia? Is it an academy? There's like some sort of facility that's in Anacostia, right just south of DC. And it was like where the fancy, it was like fancy apartments. I think it was the Air Force, because everybody makes jokes that the Air Force is rich and it's for the smart ones. I don't have a dog in the fight, so please don't. I'm not being disrespectful. I'm just repeating what they say, what I've heard people say. But anyway, it was one of those where it was like officers had these special houses that were nice looking. And I felt like they were, it was Anacostia, so it could have been Air Force, maybe it was Navy. Anyway, this particular woman was like on her way to be an officer or whatever. And anyway, she was assaulted by someone who, allegedly assaulted by someone who was like training the officers or something like that to be better officers or whatever. Anyway, and as a result of the trauma that she faced, number one, it took a mighty long time for that person to be brought to justice is what I mean to say. The person that the perpetrator, it took a minute for him to get brought to justice. And her story wasn't the only one that was in that documentary. It's just hers stood out. And as a result, her whole life was changed. Like how her intimacy with her husband was different. Like, I don't want to be too graphic, but like she would always have to let him know when it was okay for them to be intimate, because otherwise she would be triggered. She would feel uncomfortable about him being too handsy, too lovey-dovey. Whatever happened to her impacted her so deeply that even the person that she was married to, who was not military service connected, I guess he is now through his wife, but he was not in the military himself. He did not victimize her. But at the same time, that's how trauma works. It doesn't matter. It's if you've not been able to heal from that experience, your whole life is colored by that experience in many ways. And in this instance, he had the patience of Job, because literally she had to literally psychologically be in the right space for them to be intimate, but they were married. And that just stuck with me so deeply, because my first thought was, I pray he stands next to her because she's going through a lot and he couldn't possibly imagine it. Whatever he thinks she's going through more. And I just worried for her, because at the same time, she also wanted to keep her military career, which I thought was wild, but that's what she wanted to do. And her military career was impacted because she was accusing an officer. And at that moment, I think they followed them throughout the docuseries. And it wasn't until the end, which felt like a year or more, before he was even brought to justice. And so that whole time, she was essentially a pariah. So not only is she dealing with real trauma of what really happened to her, and not just once, but like several times, but also she's not even able to continue to advance appropriately in the vocation that she chose. And so ever since that kind of catapulted me into being delicate, but also being there to support conversations about sexual assault in the military, and advocating in the way that made sense for me for more supports in place, not to mention like people who identify as queer and the rates at which they're victimized as well in the military. Like, I don't know all the stats, but I know it exists. And I know that there could always be more done to support people. It's just the rates are pretty high, and the instances of abuse that we see all the time, or at least that make the news, tend to be of women, again, that have happened to women. But I don't put it past a predator to prey on anyone, especially anyone who's deemed weaker than them, or who is something like a pariah, or not a pariah, but who's on the periphery anyway, because that's what predators do. They capitalize on the fact that, or they victimize people who they deem to be weaker for whatever reason, and then they turn around and punish them for being weaker. Like, they target them for being weaker, and then they punish them at the same time, saying, well, ain't nobody gonna believe you because you. You know, it is what it is. Suck it up and let me keep being the predator that I am. And so anyway, so like I said earlier this year, my chapter was a part of a conversation. My sorority has a military, where can I describe it? It's like a committee that supports military women who are members of our organization. And so it was a tough conversation. It was tight, but it was right. It was a good conversation, even though it was uncomfortable in moments, because it needed to be said. And I know that other organizations, the other sororities in the NPHC are having these conversations too, because all of us have tons of members who are in the military. Yeah, just like the fraternities. So 4 years ago, so 2018 first started me on this journey to learn more about military women and their relationship with sexual assault. And so flash forward to 2020, and the pandemic is happening, and everybody's home and glued to social media and the TV and trying to find things to engage with and things to do. And whereas one time I watched less TV and I was engaged in less news and politics on social media, by 2020, I was deep off in, I still wasn't super engaging in TV so much, but I was definitely on social media and political social media. And at this point I was heavily on activist talk, basically, not activist talk, because I wasn't on TikTok in 2020. I wasn't on TikTok in 2020. I was on Twitter. And anyway, but I was beginning to be on political and social activist Twitter in 2020, because so many other things have happened, especially the more I started to pay attention to and elevate the conversations of trans folks who were talking about the trans folks that were being victimized across the country. And so anyway, so I just kind of naturally fell into more conversations and was connected to more people who were talking about things that were impacting marginalized communities that you wouldn't necessarily see on your nightly news or even on cable for real. So anyway, I remember seeing the story about a soldier at Fort Hood, which I had already heard that Fort Hood was not the best place in the whole wide world. I heard a lot of stories from people who had served time in Fort Hood or knew people at Fort Hood who reminded me of the stories that came out of Fort Hood in Texas. And anyway, so I remember hearing the story of a soldier by the name of Vanessa Guillen coming up missing. And I remember thinking, oh, shoot, here we go. Here we go. There's some BS, because soldiers just don't come up missing. You don't come up missing, not in no military. You don't. From what I learned, you don't come up missing unless you were in combat. Outside of that, unless some freakish incident happened, you don't just come up missing. They know your every move. They know when you on leave and where you're going, because you have to report that. Or they know exactly where you are or where you're supposed to be when you're at work and on base, but you're not active duty. And they certainly know where you are when you're on active duty. And so there are very few chances for you to come up missing unless you doing some devious stuff. And so anyway, like, you going AWOL, and that's a whole nother matter. But anyway, so she come up missing, and then she's missing for a minute. And later it's discovered that she had been killed, but I didn't hear, I didn't understand, I didn't know the details of her murder. I just knew that she had been, her remains had been found, and that's it. Watching this documentary, I am Vanessa Guillen. I learned that there was a whole hashtag about it, and the only reason why I'd heard about it on social media and it finally made it to the news was because her family kept hustling and working hard and got, and by the grace of God, got connected with some other people who were military connected, former military, who helped to amplify her voice. People in the legal community and things like that, who helped to amplify her voice or the voice of the family. But she was missing for, I think, several months. And the thing that's wild about it is that she was on her posted, she was at work on the base, and then she came up missing. And again, the military know where you are at all times, unless you are purposely being devious or you're like on vacation or something like that. I'm sure that there's most times, how about that? But definitely when you're at work, they know where you are. Unless you decide to be trash and or do your own thing. And then that's another matter, but then you're going to get in trouble. And so she goes missing. She goes missing at work. Well, flash forward, two other soldiers, I believe that she worked with, were responsible for her demise. And it's like that vicious cycle done over, over and over and over again. She was assaulted. The documentary explains that they believe that she was assaulted. She had reported what had happened to her, but they believe that those reports went unnoticed. And her death was the result of those... her death was the result of those reports being gone unheard. I'm not going to say too much more about the doc because I want you to watch it, but they do identify the people who saw her last. They identified them, and I'm just going to stop there because there's more to the story that you need to hear. The other piece that you need to hear is there was some legislation that was supposed to come out of it. And in 2020, you remember who was in office. There was some legislation that was supposed to come out of it, but conveniently, nothing happened. And again, I'll leave you to deduce what you think happened, because the documentary goes just straight forward and says it. But it just... two things that struck me: the perseverance of her family, certainly her sister, who was a teenager at the time, who was basically the spokesperson for her family. Her mother did not speak English well, and so they were a Latinx family. I keep saying another name because I know a person that whose last name is Guillen. It's just she has a different first name, but Vanessa's sister. Her younger sister was the one who was the spokesperson for the family and going on Capitol Hill and stuff and bringing her mama along. But she was the main person talking. But you could see the heartbreak and the frustration in her mama's face. Even 2 years later, you could see the heartbreak and frustration in her boyfriend's face. It's a wild story. And that... there's a lot of questions that it comes up, and systemic failures are the first one. Again, when you're talking about trauma and sexual assault in the military, you have to acknowledge the systemic failures that allow that sort of thing to happen. And you have to recognize that things do need to change. And so when it comes to the legislation, I'll leave you to watch the documentary to learn more about it, to hear it. But there's some good legislation that's on the table that could really be helpful in not eliminating situations where a person is victimized, a woman is victimized, but certainly will help make it harder for their attackers to get away with it. which is heck of a consolation prize. But right now, it's better than a woman going missing for months with no, and the family having no justice, no, in the military. Something about that is just so unnerving to me, because again, your life is not your own. Your time is really not your own when you're in, when you're active in the military. And I'm just like, how are you going to come up missing and nobody be pointed in the right directions? Cause there's a cover up. And so anyway, just pay attention, watch that documentary. Again, it's on Netflix. It came out on the 12th, November, no, November 17th, my bad. And let me switch gears really quickly, to talk about Master of Light, which was the HBO doc that was released. When was this released? It was released November 16th. So Master of Light came out on HBO Max on the 16th, and I Am Vanessa Guillen came out on the 17th. And so I watched I Am Vanessa Guillen first, and then I watched Master of Light. The reason why I watched Master of Light is because it took me a minute. I'll be honest with you. It took me maybe a day or two to decide to watch it, because I didn't think I was emotionally there. I had already watched I Am Vanessa Guillen, and that already broke up my heart. And I didn't think I was ready to watch more, someone else deal with more trauma at the hands of another person. I didn't think I wanted to do that, but I'm glad that I did, because this documentary, which features the painting, and it features George Anthony Morton, who is a classical painter who spent 10 years in federal prison for dealing drugs. Now, there's a caveat to that. It has everything to do with his mother. I'll go back and I'll talk about that in a second. But the reason why I was drawn to it initially was because he's from Kansas City. He's from Kansas City, and I was familiar with a lot of his stomping grounds that he showed in the doc when it came to Kansas City. And so I'm like, oh, okay. And the accent felt familiar to me. And I just, let me go on and watch this. I enjoy getting slices of life from centers of the country that you don't normally hear from. No matter what the slice of life is, it's important to hear that story, because we are all not, we're not a monolith. Americans are not a monolith. Black Americans are not a monolith. The experience is different from region to region, from state to state, from city to city. And so I ended up watching it. And again, I'm from Kansas City. So he's a master painter, a classical painter. I was about to say fine art, but a classical painter whose muse, or the style that he likes to paint in, is Rembrandt. That's the painter that influences him the most. And throughout the docuseries, is it a series or is it a movie? Throughout the movie, when he's unpacking his trauma, he's in the Nelson Atkins Museum, which is a beautiful museum if you're ever in Kansas City. Kansas City has a thriving art center that you wouldn't know existed unless you paid attention to the art world, to the art and arts and entertainment world. And I think it's ironic that I go from one arts and entertainment center to the next, because Baltimore, I talk about how thriving and rich Baltimore's art scene is. And I'm thankful that I moved from one thriving art scene to another one. And they're both different and exciting in their own way. And so anyway, so I grew up going to the Nelson Atkins. I love that museum. But I also remember seeing some of the slums that George Anthony showed in the docuseries. And so here it is. George Anthony Morton, classically trained painter who did 10 years in prison for selling drugs. How he got there In the beginning of the docuseries, we meet him recognizing that, you know, he's gotten an immense opportunity to really overhaul his entire life. He's always been a drawer, but he began to be a painter in prison. And so he has mixed feelings about him going to prison, but he never shies away from the fact that prison is the reason why he's able to enjoy the success that he's enjoying now. He's been in Amsterdam. People are calling him. He's been in any sort of art epicenter you can think of. He's beginning to go to those. He's beginning to be invited to those spaces as an honored guest because his work is so good. You see him painting in the dock, which gives me joy because I love to paint. I'm not good at it and I'm not trained in any way, but I love to paint. And so there's a peace that comes when you're working on, a project that won't be finished for days, even months. There's something about that because it's gives you time to really make it your own, really make it what you want to be, get the image that's in your head and onto the canvas. And there's something peaceful about that. Like you can just escape and be painting the same corner of the canvas for hours, adding new details. You know what I mean? That there's a piece of that. And it's very clear that his happy is in painting. And so we see him going to his happy place while he's also talking about the immense trauma that he's dealt with and seeing the trauma that his family is still going through. So he's one of three kids to his mom, and they all have different fathers, but they all share their mother in common, and they all lived with their mother at one time. And we see George Anthony going back and forth between Atlanta, where he lives with his partner and daughter, and Kansas City, where his people live. And then again, he's traveling the world, or he's painting live in the Nelson Atkins, and he's being interviewed by the local TV station and reporters and things like that, and news journalists and things like that. But throughout this story, we learn that initially we learn that his mother was pinched too. When he got picked up, his mother was picked up too. And his mom was between a rock and a hard place. And they couldn't find anything on her, but they were able to find something on him. And so that's why he went up for 10 years. Throughout the course of the film, one of his siblings tells him, "That's not quite true. What mommy told you, that's not quite true. You might want to go run it past her again." And so I'll leave you to, so remember I told you that his mama had a hand in him going to prison for 10 years. I will leave you to watch that to learn exactly what sort of hand that she had into it, because it broke my heart. If you think you know, I think I guarantee you don't exactly know. You might have an idea, but it's worse than what you think. And so in the middle of this documentary, he's coming to terms with that. Here's the other thing that I really want to talk about. So I think we've heard before, this documentary wants us to be reminded that George Anthony is split between two worlds. He's got this whole new opportunity. He's not even fresh out of prison at this point. He's been out a couple of years now. 3 years at this point by the time we're meeting him. And he's got these massive opportunities to just overhaul his entire life. He's got a partner that loves him, a partner that, to be honest with you, is still trying to figure out how to be the best partner for him. And I recognize she comes across as kind of prickly to his family, but prickly for good reason. His family, in a lot of ways, specifically his mother, is a source of a lot of his trauma. And we see George Anthony going to therapy, which is a wonderful thing. But She's overprotective of him. And I've seen me do that in my husband. I've seen my husband do that for me. Like, it, when you care about someone and you've seen them at their happiest, you want them to stay there. And you can immediately, when you're not in the situation, you can immediately identify the source of their unhappiness. But when you are, there's a certain lane that you still must travel in that's hard to navigate. It's hard to navigate. And what we see is George Anthony and his partner grappling with that. And in fair, there are cuts in there that don't put her in the best light. I don't think it's totally what we see as it's their relationship is totally as it's depicted in the show, because he says on numerous occasions, she saved me. She saved my life. She is my rock. So their love relationship is not all tumultuous, but they do fight about her protectiveness over him against his family. She doesn't have the same connections to his family that he do. She's only recently met his family, which again is another reason why she feels detached. That said, there's a certain lane you have to walk in. There is. And the fact remains, it's not an either or. I think the impossible situation that George Anthony is set up with is, do I cut off my entire family and go start a whole new life? Or do I figure out what life is like with them still in my life, but keeping them at a distance? I think it's not either or. I think it's a mixture. I think you find a new way of moving and behaving. I think you do not even, if you set boundaries, and if they overstep them, you push them, you protect your boundary. But to ask someone to cut out everyone that they knew in their life because of trauma that they might be connected with, the source of George Anthony's trauma is his mother, who herself was completely traumatized, had him as a child herself, wasn't super supported as a child, as a teen mom. It's like a vicious cycle. And so do you end that cycle by cutting off the traumatizers? So what happens when what do you do when you yourself are traumatizing other people? Because the fact remains, what we know is that George Anthony has anger issues. And while it's not alluded to or expressed in any way that he's physically violent to anyone, he definitely has moments where his anger gets the better of him and it's hard for him to communicate. And haven't we all been there? I've certainly been there several times. But I think it's just, I think this doc raises more questions than it answers, and I think that's okay. I think that's why I like it so much. We see life happen in this docuseries, in this movie. We see life happen. George Anthony bails his mama out of jail in the first 10 minutes of the movie. Of the doc, he bails his mama out of jail. First 10 minutes. We see his mama going from, I'm sorry I wasn't there for you the way I should have been, to blaming him for, or getting mad at him for, quote unquote, holding on to the past. She waffles back and forth like that. And so does he in some ways. We see him literally in therapy, which I think is revolutionary. And made me a little uncomfortable in spots, but also we need to see that. Because again, this is not a perfect ending. It just ends. We know that he is a star. We know he is very talented, and that people, anybody in any industry would want to get a piece of him. And so we're left with some questions. And I invite you to go watch that documentary again. It's Master of Light. Because again, while he's talking about this ugly aspects of life, he's making some of the most beautiful art. It's great. And it's also super thought provoking, and it's in line with the type of documentaries that I'm used to that I've come to know in HBO. Netflix is hit or miss with their documentaries because they just churn out so many of them. HBO and PBS have always been the ones for me in my life who've churned out content that was like Whoa. You got to sit with that. Like, after you finish it, you got to sit with that. Sit with that information. It's thought-provoking, conversation-starting sort of documentaries. Because nothing about that was pretty apart from his art. And the fact that he's going to therapy to try to be a better partner and a better father. And that you do see in the docuseries, or the movie, you see his partner trying, really trying, not understanding what a loving family, what being around a cutthroat family is like. She didn't grow up like that. And George Anthony reminds her and us of that all the time while he's trying to figure out, when every time she says, you gotta take a step back, he's like, you don't know what it's like. Can you take a step? You don't know what it's like to take a step back from your family, because you've never been given a reason to do that. And so for you to say that just so easily, it's not as easy as you think. And that's a real conversation. And so she says stuff like that. And then you see her physically going with him to Kansas City to celebrate. I think it was either Christmas or it was, maybe it was Christmas. It was, you know how sometimes, depending on the culture where you are, after a holiday, people shoot off fireworks. It's an American thing. And it's a certain city thing. My brother told me, I didn't even realize this, but they shoot fireworks in Louisiana for Christmas. I didn't know that. But like, why should you just do it for 4th of July? You should shoot fireworks at any time. Shoot, they shoot fireworks off every time the O's get a home run. So, and they shoot fireworks off when the Ravens enter the, come on the field. So, and we hear it all because we up the street. Anyway, so yeah, but you see her trying, which I love, because anyone who is a partner to someone who's dealt with family trauma, you got to have patience. And that's something that I've been learning over the years too. And something certainly that my brother or my husband has learned. Because no, I don't know anybody whose family is perfect, but I do know that it is hard when you can identify a family source of trauma or harm to your partner. It's hard for you not to be supportive, even when your partner keeps going around. That's the source, the known source of their trauma. That's hard. And I'm not insinuating that either one of my husband or my story is anywhere near George Anthony's. I'm just saying that we can all identify. We can all identify a toxic family member in our significant other's family that they keep going around, even though we see how toxic they are to our significant other and the people around them. And grappling with that, you time enough for them, but like, there's time and place for everything. You know what I mean? Anyway, it's a good doc. Watch it. I wouldn't watch them back to back like I did. You need some space and breathing room, but definitely watch them both. They're good for good reasons, for different reasons. There is no conclusion, no right answer to the Master of Light doc. There is a right answer to the I Am Vanessa Guillen. I don't want that to happen to anyone. I know her family doesn't want that to happen to anyone else. No soldier should come up missing, or number one, be victimized in the course of sacrificing their own bodies. And also, what? Come up missing for months while at work? You're kidding. You're really fooling. Anyway, so I'm hopeful that legislation comes to fruition. I'll follow up on it because I need to do some research to see if the thing is even still live this year. But yeah, definitely watch both of these documentaries. Watch both of them. All right, so that's a show. I did a show. I ran it a lot. I always rant. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. If this is your first time listening, thank you so much. Feel free to leave me positive reviews, 4 or 5 stars on the social or on the apps, wherever you listen to this. Spotify would be great if you went there and rated it. Share this episode with anyone you think might dig it, or share any of my other episodes. I appreciate you. I have been enjoying doing these. I got a tickle in my throat. I've been enjoying doing these shows. And again, I'm going to continue to do it until it's no longer enjoyable. But for now, it's still very much enjoyable. Nevertheless, I still need help expanding the reach of this thing. So I thank you in advance for rating it, sharing it, rating it and sharing it, and continuing to listen. So thank you so much. Have a good day. Take care of yourself. Do that boring thing. It'll be fine. But take care of yourself. This is a great month because we're wrapping up a year and you get an opportunity to start something new. I'm not talking about nutrition plans. I'm not talking about weight loss. If that's your goal, that's your goal. But I'm literally talking about, this is an exciting time because you can set goals for the new year. You can reevaluate relationships. It's a good time to do it. And set new goals for yourself. This is exciting. And I want that for you. I want good things for you. Just like I want them for myself. So anyway, that's enough. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.